I'm Dr. Rob Califf, and I'm glad you've joined us for another one of our interviews with interesting people in cardiology. As you know, the goal of these interviews is to bring out what has motivated people to do fascinating and impactful things in the field of cardiology, hopefully to inspire young people to think carefully about what they're going to do with their careers. So we have Dr. Jane Somerville with us today. Welcome to our interview.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So I've done a little bit of reading about you and asking around, and you've had a very interesting life history. Tell us a little bit about where you were born and what was happening while you were growing up.
Well, I'm a Londoner. I was born in Kensington, London, and went to school there. And then the war came. I'm a war child, and we were sent off, and I went off to a boys' school, which is the best education you could have if you want to go into the male professions. And then went back to school in London at Queen's College London and went to medical school.
Well, what about your parents? What did they do?
My parents were journalists. My mother was a news reporter during the war, and my father had left the, I don't know, I didn't have one of those around, which was good.
So your father was not around?
Not around after I was about six. So my mother brought me up.
What did a news reporter do, a female news reporter in World War II?
Well, I suppose reported the news in London. There was a lot of news. We were being bombed, you know. And in fact, I can just remember the searchlights and being taken from my nursery to go to a shelter. Well, a news reporter reported on news, food, you know, whatever was going on in the country, because all the men had gone off to the war.
I can't resist asking this. You know, the King's speech was such a popular movie in the last year. Have you seen that?
Of course. And I can remember going, crowding, being summoned when at school to listen to the King's, when the King was speaking. It was actually a bit of a nightmare around those little round radios, and you wondered if he was ever going to get it out. But he was a much respected figure, and we had pictures on Pathé News. Went to the newsreels and saw him going around the bombed areas. Great man.
And did you think the movie was on target?
I thought it was on target. Very good.
I really enjoyed it, despite our history in South Carolina of having had a little trouble with the Brits.
I don't want to hear about that.
So, and you had a brother, as I understand it?
I have a stepbrother, same mother, and he went off to the war and was taken at Singapore by the Japanese and was in camp. But he's still alive. He's a tough character.
Well, we have some interesting connections, actually, that we'll get into. The most interesting to me shortly, but you may not know it, but we have a medical school in Singapore now, which is the Duke.
Yes, I did.
National University of Singapore Medical School. So I've been learning a lot about the Asian perspective, which is
very different from our own.
So you went on to this boys' school. Was it literally a bunch of boys and you, or how did
it? It wasn't a bunch of boys. It was a proper, smart boys' preparatory school that had been evacuated from the East Coast because they thought the Germans would invade there. There are a number of schools in that bracing bit of England, and they'd been moved to North Wales. And the headmaster, with some reluctance, decided he would take a few girls if the parents asked, and they were relatives of boys who were already there. And I had a cousin there, and actually all children were ordered out of London. And so I went up to North Wales. For 3 years I was at a boys' school, had a good education, but it taught me a lot about boys and that men aren't much different.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I don't know if one should have this go across the wire, but I mean, first of all, they have to do things in gangs that very few can confront you as an individual. I mean, as they grow up, they do it in the bar or in their clubs or wherever they do it and agree. The other thing is somewhat economical with the truth to protect themselves at the expense of dumping you or whoever around. And three, girls are lesser beings. And I suppose at school we were.
Well, I'm actually going to want to come back to that when we talk about mentoring a little bit in the future generation, because I think views on this do have relevance. But don't you think the tables have turned lately? Aren't the girls really in charge now in schools and universities?
I think the girls are educationally often much smarter, but women have two jobs. There's no doubt about it. Most women, I don't say all, I'm not a generalizer, but, you know, they want to have a family and they want to... So they have to mainly run the family with help, and I think men are much more helpful than they ever were. I don't know whether they like it, but they still, if they want their careers, it's very tough. So I don't know that the tables have turned, and I'm not sure. I've never really thought. I was very proud to be a woman. I don't want to be a man. Why should I be liberated to behave like a man? Couldn't think of anything worse. But nevertheless, I would like to be, if I'm doing an equal job, I'd like to have equal pay. And perhaps the most important thing is, I would like to be considered if I had equal ability. I mean, maybe I didn't, but there was always this thing, well, you know, she's a woman. I'd like equal consideration in the professions.
And cardiology is one that has, next to urology, has the smallest number of women. Why do you think that is? Compared to other areas of medicine.
Well, first of all, there was a lot of competition amongst the men through the way up, because it was a very moving specialty, a very interesting specialty, and you could also make a lot of money in it, specialty. So there were a lot of very smart men in it. That's number one. Number two, not every woman wants to be irradiated, to be fried, thank you very much, in there. And although some very distinguished interventionists are around, I think it might not be their first wish to do that. And I suspect that's one of the things that's influenced the statistics now.
Well, let's back up a little bit then. We'll get to this, what's happened in the field. But you came back from this school away. You were still quite young. When did you decide you wanted to be a doctor?
Oh, well, I came back to the school in 1944 when the flying bombs were on, dropping on London, and that wasn't very nice. You didn't know whether to get off the bus or stay on the bus. But anyway, and I came back to Queen's College, London, where I took my exams and got into medical school, and I wanted to go to a very male medical school and Guy's Hospital, very macho, great fun, but quite tough. And
how many women were in your class?
Well, just a minute. I had decided I would do medicine when I was about 13 or 14, because on one of the holidays where one was sent out because one's mother was working, I was reading the medical books that were in the shelves, rather dusty medical books, but quite graphic, and I thought, oh, this is very interesting. I like this. So I decided then.
Had you been around patients or...?
No. We're no doctors in my family. They're journalists. They write good English, which I can't.
So you ended up in this medical school that was mostly men.
They had to take 9% of women by order of the government then. It's about 55% to 60% now. So they had to take women. And you were carefully interviewed. And I was interviewed by the one-eyed dean with a black patch in his eye. But he had quite an eye for the girls, I think.
Uh-huh.
So I was lucky I got in. He said, did I think I could manage with men? I said, that was one of the questions. I said, oh yes, I've been to school with boys, and there wasn't a lot of difference as far as I was concerned. And I think I got in on that remark.
That's interesting. So then you did all the things you have to do in medical school. Did you find the medical students were a cut above the boys at the other school, or were they really the same?
Oh, I wasn't interested in them. I thought boys were very silly when I was at school with them. I mean, I couldn't believe what daft things they did just because they were stronger than we were. No. The medical students, well, I didn't really know. I didn't choose my boyfriends from medical students too much, a bit. You know, safety in numbers.
So you must have done well in medical school and
well,
landed.
No, I didn't do particularly well. I mean, I did adequately, but we had a half of the year, and the other half of the year was very much better than our half. We were the lesser half and were sort of rather put to the side. But I got on... Well, you got through. It wasn't too difficult. Just had to sit learning all that stuff. And I liked the clinical side very much. And by chance, and it was by chance, I won the clinical medal for surgery, which meant that one kind of got a leg up on the house appointments. So instead of being bad, then one got into the sort of good group. So I got on the house, which was the thing to do. I got a house job at Guy's Hospital.
As a surgeon?
No. I was in the Department of Medicine. That was a bit of a madhouse. And then because I had this gold medal in clinical surgery, they asked me what I wanted to do, and I said that I wanted one of these post-registration jobs. I wanted to do thoracic surgery with Sir Russell Brock, because I had completely become mesmerized by heart surgery. Because Blaylock visited, because we had a reciprocal arrangement with the Johns Hopkins. So I'd heard him lecture as a student, and I said, ooh, that is for me. I'm going to be a surgeon.
And that was based on a lecture, not actually being in the OR.
Well, I then went and I did. I was a dresser on the firm of Sir Russell Brock, and it was like one long incident of MASH. And then I went to his house. I became his house officer. That was fun for a year. Never a dull moment.
Now, sir, congenital heart surgery back then was pretty
rough, wasn't it?
What was actually done?
In the late 50s, 57, 58, I would have been a house surgeon. I was 56, 57. Well, they did Blaylocks, and they did pulmonary valvotomy, and they did co-optations. That was a bit of a nightmare, because you had to be strong to hold the clamps, and Russell Brock took an awful long time to make the anastomosis. And he did mitral valvotomies. That was fun. Great thing was to get up in the morning and see if I get my finger in the heart. In that year, I realized that my hands were not actually connected to my brain or any other part, and I was extremely clumsy, and that surgery was not for me. Nor did I like going back to the theater. I thought, if you've been there all day messing about, why in heaven's name couldn't you get it right? So, and the other thing is, I'd spied a man I wanted to marry, or I wanted to cavort with. And they weren't really compatible to do surgery and be out for a date.
That all makes sense. But surgery in that time, you didn't have cardiopulmonary bypass.
It was just coming in. We had this Lilly High apparatus, which obviously perfusing on azygos venous flow, which obviously didn't give the patient enough. So they died of cerebral edema, which was a terrible nightmare, and one didn't know what was going on, and hyperpyrexial. Donald Ross was the senior registrar, like the chief resident in your setup, and so he was, you know, very helpful. But, I mean, they still died, and Brock would come marching in at 7 o'clock in the morning, and you had to sleep in the ward, and there was no intensive care area, and anyhow, I, the house officer, didn't know what was going on. As for consenting the patients, it seemed one was just didn't know. I mean, what we told the patients was a whole lot of nonsense, or rather the relatives. It was terrible, terrible.
But it was really early days. I mean,
well, it was early days, but you can, you know, it became clear to me. It was wonderful when they did open heart surgery. We had hypothermia, mm-hmm. And we used the bath. We didn't use the bath because Brock thought it was anesthetic to put a patient in the bath and bring it into the theater. We had venous cooling, which Donald Ross had invented. And visitors used to come and see this. So we had 5 minutes in the heart. It was all right for Sir Thomas Holmes Sellers, who was an amazing surgeon and could really close an ASD, but down in Southwark, it wasn't quite, there were a few smash and grabs that didn't quite work out.
Yeah. So you could see the difference in surgical dexterity.
Oh, yes, of course you could. Yes.
All right, so you learned, it sounds like you learned a lot during that
I learned an awful lot, and I loved cardiac surgery. I just didn't think it was for me. Well, I was actually very clumsy, there's no doubt about it, and I've always been clumsy, and that's how it is.
But then you went into, did you go right into pediatric cardiology then?
No. I went to do proper adult medicine. You had to, if you're going to go onto the medical side, you had to do your general medicine first and be properly trained and do your membership at the College of Physicians. Then you might be allowed to specialize. So I did that. But my heart was in a congenital heart disease, and we had Maurice Campbell there, and he was always giving lectures about this thing, and he always kept his notes separately, and I used to wonder why. And so he knew a lot about the follow-up of patients. So there was plenty of congenital heart disease in Guy's because of Blaylock having been to Guy's. They used to come across London Bridge limping, blue. I'd never seen such patients in my life.
Why did you fixate on congenital heart disease?
Because of Blaylock, because it was fascinating, because you could actually make a diagnosis. We had cardiac catheterization then in cardiology. And you could do something.
Is it fair to say that the content was interesting and challenging, but you were also inspired by people?
I don't know.
The
content was challenging, and of course I married a cardiologist, which was also quite inspiring. I think Walter Somerville was a very special man. That was in 1957. I remember I had to go and ask my chief if I could get engaged. So those are the days. And Brock said to me, "Are you going to marry that chap that says I shouldn't operate on aortic stenosis?" And I said, "Well, that is the intention, sir." "Oh, my goodness," he said. Blinked.
So your career was then, you got through all that training, and then you were ready to start your own thing?
I went to the heart hospital, which was like Mecca for heart diseases, and there was the great Paul Wood, mm-hmm. of whom there's never been any greater as a clinician, as a thinker, as a mentor. There was a real person that was an example of how you should practice medicine, and you had to write your mistakes down, which I've always done. You had to keep, and if you didn't...
Okay, so what was it about Paul Wood? I've heard a lot of people say what you just said. I've never actually asked anyone to describe...
Paul was extremely unattractive looking, amazing blue eyes like limpid pools of copper sulfate, but an amazing teacher, he could bring simplicity to the bedside and made you think logically about cardiac physiology. And then he would correlate the physical signs with the catheter data, which had to be accurate. But he could do it at the bedside, and if he'd made a mistake and the catheter showed something else, then he'd correct his diagnosis initialed, and he'd correct it on his filing cards. And he just knew. He kept a record of everything himself. I've still got his cards in his writing. No, on cards with the diagnosis. And he was the first person, it's very interesting now, to show the vasodilator effect and the acetylcholine effect in the pulmonary arterioles. And he said the only way to manage pulmonary hypertension is to find what's making it constrict. Mm-hmm. So now they found all that, he would be so happy. But we used to have all this testing of pulmonary hypertension. So one grew up with a lot of Eisenmenger patients with a lot of pulmonary hypertension and with a lot of wisdom coming. And he did not let you to think loosely. If you had loose thoughts, you'd be known and you'd be exposed in front of everybody. He said, "That's not right. You must be accurate."
So a high level of integrity is what you're describing to me with...
Well, a high level of ability as well as integrity and honesty, clinical honesty and good observation. And if you hadn't made the observation, you had to write the diagnosis after outpatients that was made in the outpatients. You had to write your physical signs, and he would call you in the morning when he was dictating his letters. They're all in his letters what was found, if he thought it was wrong. He said, "This doesn't make any sense. Explain yourself." So it's a hard training.
And then he died suddenly?
He died in 1962. Of a left anterior descending in the arms of my husband, because he fortunately decided to consult him. But he had sent for me, and I was down in Guy's, of course, looking at congenital heart disease, when he was shouting for his junior staff. Anyhow, my husband looked after him in 1962 in the Middlesex Hospital. And he wouldn't be resuscitated, and the story is well known. He said, "Don't let that chap that's the house officer, who became a very distinguished neurologist. He said, don't let him take a knife to my chest and open my chest. Hmm. And defibrillation, it was, I think, July, defibrillation machine, Bernie Lown, was not published, and I think until the September, October, it wasn't there. But otherwise, his life could have been saved, because they watched him with ventricular tachycardia degenerate into ventricular fibrillation.
Wow.
With nothing. So Walter stood by the bedside with this house officer.
So that's hard to imagine today, isn't it? Like a lot of things.
He didn't have a computer either. I mean, one doesn't realize. Important year, 1962, a lot happened.
So how did that change your career when it sounds like
well,
he was an inspirational
figure?
Well,
it didn't really change my career. We didn't have heart surgery in the Institute of Cardiology and Heart Hospital, which was a tiny hospital. We didn't have heart surgery till about 1965. But this, of course, had an advantage. The physicians who were on teaching hospitals could send the patients to who they wanted, to whom they thought did best. And I'd been connected to Evan Bedford, and so and also Walter was the number two cardiologist there, so it was very easy to see what was going on in the Middlesex. Very good surgery, the best series of atrial septal defects of the day. I was connected to guys, but I realized very quickly that you really couldn't cope with congenital heart disease unless you knew infants and children. So Richard Bonham Carter let me go to Great Ormond Street, and actually gave me my first consultant session, which was there. Strangely. Sure. So I learned there what was going on. It was fascinating. Woodson was an amazing surgeon. It all looked so easy. You saw all these babies. Actually, I've got one now who was a baby at that time. She had an AV canal and still going, not very strong, but managing.
Interesting. So, in full disclosure, you know, I have a daughter with congenital heart disease who's 32 now. She had an AV canal and a coarctation.
Wow, that's a bad pair of lesions.
It was a bad pair of lesions. And, you know, I arrived as an intern in San Francisco in 1979 and walked out on a cold day with Sharon in my arms, and she turned blue.
Oh, poor fellow.
And turned out Paul Ebert was there.
Well, he was a great
pretty amazing surgeon.
Yes, amazing surgeon. Did he do the canal as well? Did he do
did
it all in one?
Or? Despite the fact that all the cardiologists told us there that it was beyond belief that you could do the coarctation and the canal and the mitral valve repair, he did it all, and 32 years later, she's
amazing.
Had her own child and doing
wonderful.
Quite well.
I'm so happy. Well, that's one of the things that struck me when I was a surgeon. Well, never was a surgeon, but when I was assisting, that there was so much abnormality left behind. That how were they to go on claiming what was such a good result when they didn't know what happened? Well, of course, survival after the theater and even leaving hospital was something to celebrate in the mid-50s, but I knew that there was a lot of abnormality in these hearts, and there was a lot. And there was no such thing as total correction. It was quite clear to me. Mm-hmm. I thought it was the silliest terminology even then, and used to say, it didn't go down very well, but one of my faults, many faults, is too much to say. Mustn't say, always say what you think.
So you got fascinated then, not just you learned about the infants and all, but your greatest claim to fame in my book is the grown-up congenital heart disease, which of course is very relevant to my family right now.
Yes, I hope somebody
but
sensible
no
looks
it
after.
At the time.
Well, no, and that's a problem. The problem really was that I wanted to be a pediatric cardiologist and practiced as a pediatric cardiologist and was allowed to do that in the heart hospital, but was not accepted as a pediatric cardiologist. Not that really matters. One often isn't accepted for what you believe in and so on and so forth. But I wanted to establish something where I would be the one. Because it was quite clear every time I went up for a job, I didn't even get on the short list. I really didn't. And then the Heart Hospital decided they would make an appointment. And I altered the advertisement, because the House Governor's office was for a consultant in congenital heart diseases. So it didn't say I had to be pediatric.
Ah.
And I didn't train as a pediatrician, so of course I've always been somewhat rejected except by a few of the great. So I also had adult beds as a physician in the heart hospital. I had adult beds. And they said to me, if you want to have more children's bed, you've got to find the money and build your own ward, which I did. I found the money and we built an extension with a roof garden on top, because I do like to have a garden. Always had a garden.
That must have been nice for the families.
Wonderful was the garden. The only problem was the house governor said you can't put more than 20 hundredweight of weight on it. And I said, oh dear, because each pot weighs that, you know. But anyhow, we didn't come through the ceiling.
So when you look back now at the grown-up...
Congenital heart?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that became... It was quite clear there needed to be a specialty. And it has been very hard to establish it. And it's still not properly organized in the United States. So if it's not organized in the United States, imagine the difficulties. It's a problem, this specialty. It is more or less organized in the UK and in a number of countries. It's a problem. When we established the World Congress of Pediatric Cardiology, as it was in 1980, the last session, which was devoted to the future, I spoke on adolescents and adults, I think, I can't remember, congenital heart disease, triumphs and disasters, because there are plenty of disasters that one very much regrets. And so that was really the launching, that one had to get on and establish this. And it's been extraordinarily difficult to do it, because, and it's not a lot easier now. It has to come because there's so many patients. And they, fortunately, the patients will demand that somebody sees them with a modicum of sense, instead of being in everybody's offices when they don't know what is a Fontan and what is a Ross and what is whatever. So it's been an extremely difficult road to establish. But it's there. And the reasons for doing it is, one, it was there. Two, somebody ought to look after these people. They suffer a lot, these patients with congenital heart disease. Why should they not have as normal a life and as best medicine as you can give them? And honestly, it's not a pediatric. They're not little children.
Right. I mean, they have a lot of interesting issues, but it's also true they just didn't exist before, right? Because they didn't survive
Strangely enough, you'd be surprised how many congenital hearts, adults and late adolescents, that I saw in my training. Of course, perhaps only 15% survive. But one actually learned about the Eisenmenger with the pulmonary hypertension and many things. In the early days, if you were a hospital that, if you were where they attracted congenital heart disease, and poor Wood had loads of them, loads of cases.
This guy is like a miracle guy. How many patients did he see a day?
Oh, God knows. A lot.
A lot. He just kept really good records.
Well, perfect records. Well, I mean, he saw each one fully. I mean, we only would see about 10 or 12 patients in outpatients. But anyway, and they'd be at ordinary cardiology as well. So one had to do ordinary adult cardiology as well, which was emerging and flourishing and blooming fabulous at the time.
Now, in the midst of all this, you had your own family.
Well, yes, but that I did. I did. I had family, had a great husband who actually wanted me to get on with my career. I always established that with any man that I was a bit serious with, that I had to have a career, and not all will accept it. But Walter, I think, thought, she's doing her career, I can live my life as I want to. And then, of course, one wanted to have a child. And I was senior lecturer at the time in the Heart Hospital to Paul Wood. I was the junior one. And so one had 3 months off. And I was very glad to get back to work, because I didn't think much of Nappycroft. And part of having so many children was not a great desire for maternal expression, but really I had such a trouble with my career. I never get on a short list. I couldn't get on. I didn't think I'd ever be a consultant. So when I became totally frustrated, I just had a child. Could get 3 months off to think and finish my MD thesis and all that stuff.
Now, are your children all doing well now?
Well, they're all alive and well and quite good looking. What more can you have? I mean, what is doing well if they're sort of having families and girlfriends and I've got three boys and one girl, you know. I think they're great. They're the best thing I've done.
And you have some grandchildren too, as I know.
I have some grandchildren, six, I think.
Do these all live in the UK? Or?
No. One in Paris, one in New York. You know, they're around and about. And I have good relationship with my children, and I think they're marvelous. None of them doctors.
Really?
No.
Why
no.
is that?
Oh, I think they thought it was too ridiculous. Too much hard work for too little money. And they had it for breakfast or dinner, you know.
So do you travel around and see them now?
Well, they come. Yeah, I see them enough, thank you.
That's great.
Yeah.
So, when you see women now trying to make it in cardiology, what advice do you have for them?
Well, I don't think that I should limit my advice to women. Strangely enough, I never grew up with that sexist attitude. And in the roaring 70s, you know, I couldn't see the point of banging on and looking unattractive to say, well, I'm a woman. But I do think we are underprivileged in the professions. And my advice would be to anybody in training, not just the women. I think for the women, I do have a special thing, because many people ask me this, but to be a good doctor now, I think, firstly, the woman must choose a suitable partner. I think that's absolutely key. And preferably somebody who's got enough maturity to deal with their emotional... I'm a pretty excitable person, and Walter was very good. You know. We won't look at that now. Just be calm, you know. Go and have a meal and be quiet. And then we look at it sensibly. But, I mean, I think you need somebody who, one, supports you, two, may have to have enough money to support. Because, I mean, it costs a lot to have a household with a support staff so you can work. I mean, you can't be ironing shirts, for instance, at night. That's rule one. Never iron a shirt. Have someone else to. Never. Never earned a shirt in my life. Just put the iron on one sleeve soon after our honeymoon and it burned. Best thing ever happened.
So
never
didn't have to worry about that again.
No. Never iron shirts. Never do. And don't. The other thing is you have a lot of guilt complex about what you're not doing in your family, your house, your children. It's never right. Other women are not at all not. So you have to ride above that. You have to keep your. You must keep your home and so forth in some sort of order, or else you're in misery. Fatigue is the great enemy to women, since you want me to discuss women. Men have much more resistance to that. And, of course, they, in general, get a bit better looked after, but not always so. So I think you just have to make sure you've got enough help to deal with your problems. Well, there are domestic problems, and it does cost money. So you need someone who's got some money. You need a mature person who can deal with your emotional responses, and someone who actually is proud and wants you to do this. I don't think I would have got where I haven't got or whatever if I hadn't had Walter. Mm-hmm. Because he provided a very secure base from which I operated, from which the naughty boys could not invade and sabotage one's ideals. God knows they tried.
So, I mean, in our discussion, let me just say, your protestation about men and women... What I really hear you saying, though, is you think there are fundamental differences that if you don't recognize them can cause you trouble.
Well, cause somebody trouble. I think that's rather a broad-based thing. I think that women can be very much better in cardiology and at things than are men. I don't think, you know, everybody, you have to be judged on your merit, and they should be judged on their merit. And that should be what real equality is about. It's not just about pay, but on their merit. And I'm not sure that the judgment is always on real merit. I think that if you didn't have to fill in M or F, and in many places you don't, they should just look at the person. And one should call oneself George or Joseph or what, even if your name is Jane or something. You know, I think it shouldn't be that. That's one thing. And, of course, then you've got your supporters. But that isn't how the world works. I think in most countries, and including my own, is that they are still very sexist. I'm sorry to say. But it's not politically correct to show it. So it's, in a sense, driven underground. But I think they are.
I mean, we can't have that
woman in a men's club. Well, you know, that prevails in my country. I don't know so much about the States because you're so busy being political correct. I sometimes wonder if you really know what you're doing underneath, but that's a comment.
Of course we don't know what we're doing. I think it was a Brit who said Americans always do the right thing after they've exhausted all other possibilities.
Well, whatever, you know, I think lots of us are like this, but for women, I think women, a medicine can be a very good career. But you shouldn't forget that you may want to have children, and you don't have to be breastfeeding in a public cafe just to show you are a woman. I mean, it's ridiculous. I think you should be proud to be a woman, be properly dressed, not look like the, you know, as if you've been run over by a bus, and a proper person. And I think that, I hope in time, people will be very glad to have your services, but you've got to have your platform well organized from where you operate to retain your happiness and control your emotional responses.
Well, let me ask you one last question, which is sort of philosophical and hard to answer, but it may, I think, for the audience, tie together a lot of issues that we don't have time to talk about. Well, you've pioneered this field of adult congenital heart disease, or whatever we want to call it, grown-up congenital heart disease. And you also are obviously very much attuned to sort of the social political environment. So if you were going to design a system now on behalf, I guess it's about 1% of people are born with congenital heart disease. Most of them are now surviving into adolescence or adulthood. If you were going to design an ideal system to provide optimal care for them, given all of the other forces at play, what would it look like?
Well, I think this is too big a question to answer. You'd need Mark II of your interview, actually. But basically, the problem is it depends on what system. You can't design the same system for every country. We are fortunate in having a free health system. For how long, who knows? But anyway, so it's different for us from a more money-oriented system, which you have with equipment and private offices and all the rest. So we can't design the same system. But basically, one needs a smooth transitional handover to someone, to a center, and the patient should know what to expect and to know they need to see specialists. There's also geographical differences. I don't really want to be drawn onto this. I'd much rather you ask me, which you said you might, about what I'm proud of or what should happen to doctors of the future. But anyhow, I don't think I can deal with this. But basically, adult patients need adult-trained doctors. I don't think pediatricians, for fear of being lynched and never been invited out again, I don't think pediatric cardiologists who have not had proper adult training or adult exposure to these patients should be looking after these patients.
Okay, so you begged you brought up the last question, which I should ask. You said two things. What are you most proud of? Which is a question I usually ask people.
Well, yes, I thought I was going to get that. So you can't really conduct your own interview, and I don't want to, but I'm most proud of that I managed to establish the World Congress of Pediatric Cardiology because we weren't getting a hearing anywhere. And that's why we did it, and it became Pediatric Cardiology and Cardiac Surgery. And it's still going, and the next meeting will be in South Africa, and I'm proud of that. I'm proud of the grown-up congenital heart services. At least it's talked about. Got much better when I left the health service. They were much better about it in the UK instead of being so jolly obstructive, as many people are. I'm proud that I've formed a patient association, which was, I think, the first in the world. And this is a good lobbying force, and the American one is excellent, and the Canadians are excellent, because they really led the way. The Canadians led the way. And I'm most proud of my family. I think they're great. They're fun, they're great, they're nice looking, thanks to Father, and they're effective. And they produce nice children. So who can have more?
That's fantastic. And so for the cardiologists in the audience, a brief word about the future. I'm sure you've thought a lot
about
this.
Well, I do think about the future. One is almost tempted to say, well, it's such a disaster, medicine is going on and so expensive. It isn't my future anyway, but I do think that cardiologists must be able to examine patients and not depend on machines. First of all, patients love being examined. They feel the doctor has touched them. Most of those that I see, quite not all, aren't capable of examining anything. If you said, what is an A wave and what does it mean, they think you're from outer space. I do think that the clinical aspect and the assessment of the history is absolutely vital, and they shouldn't even be allowed to do stuff until they can at least do that. Of course, intervention is going to be continue good, because people, and it's very successful, and I really admire what they've done. And I think that's going to be more and more. And whether prevention will really be successful, let us see. There's certainly a lot of talk, but I think we have to face such huge issues of obesity and diabetes and all these things that congenital heart disease will still be just the icing on the cake. But nevertheless, if you've got it, you need the best for life.
Fantastic. This has been a lot of fun. I've enjoyed talking with you, and I'm sure the audience will appreciate it,
too. I hope so. Thank you. Thank you very much.